So sorry. Hopefully we won't have this happen again for too much longer. That should clear it out. I think I've cleared up everything else. It's on the Zoom interface. So I've rebroadcast, so we should be opening back up. Participants should be coming back on. Maybe give it just 30 seconds or so, and then we should be good. Apologies for everyone.
Okay, thanks.
Were we the only ones who got kicked off, or did everybody occur? Everybody?
It was everybody. It's a restart again.
All right. Unnerving when that happens.
Yes, it is.
Are we waiting for others to join us? Is that what's happening?
I think we should be set to go. Ms. Drummond, it looks like you are.
Okay, yeah. I had been dropped out. Was that the entire system that went down?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, all right.
We should be back on now.
Anyone else see duplicate?
Let's wait. Is Mr. Bricklin on? Is he back on?
Mr. Bricklin is here. Ms. Drummond, I have you logged in two separate.
It's possible I was logged in and then that wasn't working, so I did the link again. So
okay. As long as you're not getting any feedback, I don't see any.
Okay. Let me know if there's a problem with my with the reception there, and we'll figure it out. So, okay. It looks like Ms. Walston, looks like we are recording again.
Yes, we are.
We are back on the record. And Ms. Clungeon, I think we just heard from Mr. Adams about his qualifications, and you were going to continue with his testimony, yes?
Correct, yeah. And I believe I was in the middle of moving to admit his report, which
yes. A bit fun, yes, I don't know if it caught. I did admit that there was no objection. That's okay. Appellant's Exhibit 8. Oh, okay. His report, you said, not just the. That was the. Okay, which exhibit is the report?
Exhibit 7. Exhibit. And CV is 8.
Okay, is there any objection to the admission of Appellant 7? It is. It is admitted.
Do we have Mr. Adams?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually am not seeing him right now. Ms. Walston?
He's coming. I'm moving him back over.
Okay.
Connected right now.
All right, I'm here. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah. Yes. Sorry about that. Looks like the system kind of locked everyone out for a little bit. But I think we're back on board.
I thought you guys voted me off the island, but okay.
No, I think everyone got voted off. So,
okay.
Ms. Clinton, you may proceed. Mr. Adams, you remain under oath.
Okay. Right. Mr. Adams, so can you tell us about what was your assignment for your review?
Yes, my assignment was to assess whether the project's impacts related to aesthetics were significant and review if how the project was consistent with the comprehensive plan, whether it complied with the applicable codes. In particular, I looked at the Silverdale Design Standards, the Kitsap County Comprehensive Plan, and the Kitsap County Code Chapter 17, which is the zoning portion of the code. Trying to determine if the project would impact the existing or future uses of the property in the immediate vicinity, and especially with the design standards, how it might be compatible or not with the conditions on the site there, with the existing character, the appearance, quality of the adjoining development, and the physical characteristics of the site.
Okay. And what did you do to analyze those issues?
So reviewed the documents that were made available to me that included the staff report, various design architectural documents from the proposal, including the building elevation, site plan, floor plans, perspective views of the proposal. Reviewed the site plan, which include delineation of the contours of the property and the surrounding area, the existing buildings in the surrounding area. I went to the site on October 31st and spent a good part of the day there walking around the entire site, visiting neighboring properties, analyzing views across the site. And I think that covers it.
Okay, and did you create, in addition to your report, did you create any images or renderings?
Yes, after we visited the site, we used a photo montage technology along with Google Earth and a modeling that we did here of the bulk and overall scale of the project to create what we call renderings, three-dimensional views of how the project may appear in the location proposed.
Okay. All right, and I'd like to introduce those renderings as well as exhibits.
Okay, what's the exhibit number on that?
So this will be an illustrative exhibit. I emailed with Ms. Purvis and Ms. Zippel about adding these. So I'm gonna pull up a screen share here of the renderings that Mr. Adams prepared.
Just a technical matter going forward, because I want to point to things at some point. Should I start pulling up these exhibits?
Sure, yeah.
How would you like me to handle that? I'm prepared to pull things up that you tell me to pull up.
Great, all right. Yeah, so could you pull up the illustrative exhibit of the view from the north?
So I think we need, Ms. Clungeon, these were not previously marked with exhibit numbers. We need to get exhibit numbers on them.
Yep.
So on these, this is an illustrative exhibit, correct? The architectural renderings?
Correct.
And I guess it would be appellant's illustrative exhibit two. I think the video wasn't one. And then should we just group them all together, or are there a number of renderings?
There are only two, so why don't we? Okay.
Well, they'll just be two then.
Yep.
2A and 2B if you need to differentiate.
Okay.
I do think there's a third version of the view, which is kind of a before and after situation. So okay. One of them is just showing the existing conditions. So I don't know I know a few lawyers call that illustrative. It's just a photograph of the site.
Okay. All right.
And I don't have a problem with the exhibits. I had replied to Ms. Clungeon that we might also just have some photos to help with the testimony. And so we'll want to admit ours as well, but I don't have a problem with them really, you know, being exhibits as, you know, for an illustrative purpose or whatever. So that's fine.
Okay. So are the parties in agreement on that we'll treat the illustrative exhibit two as an illustrative exhibit? It sounds like there is consensus on that, but.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay.
Are you ready for me to share this?
Why don't we?
Yes.
Good.
All right. Hopefully, let me know when you can see my screen. Or my exhibit, I guess.
All right, yes, we can see it.
Okay. This is a view of the project, and we'll come back to this later in testimony to locate this, this is a view from the neighboring property, which is to the north of the subject parcel, looking southwest towards the inlet. And the tan or gray, depending on how your monitor set up structures in the view, are the proposed structures. Again, just to briefly outline the process, we used Google Earth and site maps with the area topography surveyed on there to locate these buildings in the landscape at the appropriate elevations. The second view is basically, you should be seeing another image at this point, is the view of the proposed buildings, again in tan or gray, from the opposite side. So standing to the southeast and looking to the southwest and looking to the northeast. And I'll be able to further illustrate exactly where these views are taken when we pull up the site plan.
Okay. All right. So why don't we get into kind of describe the area. Can you give some background about the parcel and the location and your impression of the area?
Absolutely. So I'm going to pull up the site plan here just so that I can point while we're speaking.
Okay, great.
And just for the record, this is DCD exhibit 33, that says on there?
That's what I see as well, yes. May I continue? Are you ready for me to continue?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So the site is a very long, a narrow parcel. It's wide in the east direction. So I'm gonna illustrate on here directly with my chicken scratch red pen.
John, one second, is there a way to remove that other, the instruction
document?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought I was only sharing one screen. I apologize. That's my technical snafu.
That's fine. It's just easier to.
Let me try that again. You should only be seeing the plan. Is that correct?
Okay, that's, yeah, that's what I see right now, that's all.
Great, sorry about that. So the plant, the site is very wide in this east-west direction. North is quote unquote up in, on this plan. Just to, and we'll go back to it later. The first view I showed you was from this perspective standing here. And the second view was from this perspective standing here. The structures themselves.
Mr. Adams, can you just state a little bit more specifically just for the in case you're reviewing a transcript rather than the video recording, just a little bit yes. more detail on your, the location, just so I've got that.
Absolutely. So the first view was exhibit, was illustrative exhibit of one. Did, oh, so we said two, right? Was yeah. the first one that two. I presented today. So that view was there standing on the porch of the restaurant that exists in this location. This label single family is misleading or it was an old label. This is now a restaurant. And then the second view, which I believe was number three, was taken standing down at here at this location, which is to the southwest of the site, looking towards the northeast. Does that help?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Great. So the structures, it's a little hard to tell because of the line work here on this drawing, but the structures, the principal structures are these buildings, which I'm going to highlight in this fat red marker. And these are the larger 3 to 4 story structures that are proposed. There is a smaller one story clubhouse structure in the southwestern corner of the site. So the proposal is these four larger buildings with a clubhouse building. It is, if you were familiar with reading the contours, you could see that it's sloping upwards to the right. So basically, the hill is sloping down this direction from the northeast to the southwest across the entire site. The view to the water is also in that same direction. So the water is this way. The principal view to the inlet is this way. What else? Sorry, just lost my notes. The parcel itself has an interesting condition of being somewhat of an outlier, which is important to point out that the, oops, it's not going to work for me. Excuse me. Technical difficulties from the marker. The parcel itself actually sticks out from the neighboring parcels in a land use sense. So this parcel is entirely zoned with these parcels here, but all of the area in blue that I'm about to highlight is actually zoned at a much lower density residential zone. Sorry, we have a crazy dog here. So everything that I just kind of scribbled on in blue is the lower density zone, and the red areas are the higher density zone. And that'll come up much more clearly when we start looking at the zoning maps together.
Mr. Adams, Adams, just for the record, you know, when you're saying here and here, somebody reading the transcript won't know we're here.
Okay, I'm sorry. I won't rely on the visuals so much. I apologize. It's my nature to kind of do that. So the adjoining land to the south, east, and west of the subject parcel, all the lower density zones, and only the parcels that are to the north of the subject parcel are share the commons zone with this parcel. So therefore, this parcel is somewhat of an outlier as it sticks in to the lower density zones. And we'll, I'll point out that such, that configuration really suggests that this parcel should be treated as a transitional parcel in terms of how one would design the massing and scale of the buildings on that lot to transition to lower scale development surrounding it. So the zone that the parcel is sit in is a regional is the RC zone. It's the regional center zone, and then the surrounding parcels on this again on the west, south, and east are the urban restricted zone. So I think we have another map to share with you. So let me see if I can do that. That some grace, hopefully. And that is the the waterfront district from the Silverdale Design Standard. And if, can you guys all see that at this point? I don't know if there's a delay.
Yes.
Great. I will zoom in to the area that is the waterfront district. We have the district is in orange. It spans Buckland Hill Road, as you can see here, and the subject parcel is on the southern border of the waterfront district for a good portion of the entire district. So what I mean by that is I will briefly draw in the subject parcel here. Again, the kind of central southern portion of the waterfront district in orange, and I can only describe it as effectively comprising close to what appears to be, visually appears to be 50% of the southern edge of the waterfront district, notwithstanding this small outlier piece that is across the inlet. Let's see there. So I also have a zoning map that I'd like to show everybody that might show some additional detail. Hopefully you guys are seeing the zoning map with the peach and blue colors. Please let me know if you're not.
Not quite yet.
Okay. Try it again. How about now?
There we go. Yep.
All right. So this is the zoning map that has been pulled off of the GIS application to Kitsap County. The regional center zone is shown in the peach color or light orange, I guess, again, just depending on your screen. The urban restricted zone is shown in, on my screen at least, a blue color. The subject parcel is, I better draw in a different color for everyone. The subject parcel is here. And as you can see, and I just said here again, but I don't know how to describe it elsewise. The subject parcel is surrounded on three sides by the blue zone and is, which would be again, the east, west, and south sides, and then the north side of the subject parcel shares the regional center zoning in peach. So it's very clear visually, at least on the zoning map, that the subject parcel is surrounded. Also talk about a little bit later, but how this is somewhat of an unusual zoning configuration where we tend to see zoning transitions happen at the center line of streets or one parcel back from streets, but not necessarily a strange two parcel back only for one lot and then back to one parcel. But we can talk about that in more detail.
Okay. And there was testimony yesterday that this zone used to be more north of Buckland Hill, and then it was extended to include the row of lots south of there, and then extended again to add only this one lot. Is that correct?
That's what I understood. I don't have the history of how the zoning was, but I've understood that from interviews with our client.
And what's your understanding of the zoning kind of along Buckland Hill there?
Yeah, so, you know, there is precedent for, you know, using large streets, especially like Buckland Hill, which is an arterial of sorts. I'm using that word informally, although it probably is legally classified as such, to have a higher intensity zone on one side and then across that major street switch to a lower intensity zone. You will sometimes occasionally see planners want to extend higher intensity zones on both sides of streets such as this because they want to have a common urban fabric on both sides of the street. So in the plan that we're looking at here, in fact, this is the strategy that seems pretty clear where you have parcel, and I'm starting to circle the parcels on the south side of Buckland Hill Road, or at least put dots on them. You have parcel after parcel after parcel that are one parcel deep that give the, and this is a large parcel, but give the zone that kind of notion that you have the same sort of urban character on both sides of the street. This is very unusual to have this kind of the subject parcel, and now I'm pointing to have it be just a one-off, be two parcels deep of high intensity zoning, especially when it's surrounded by such a much lower intensity zoning. You can even begin to see the white or gray indications of the sizes of the structures in this low intensity zoning on this map. And you can just see how small the buildings are in this UR zone relative to the large size of the parcels. So it's just very unusual to have this kind of insertion of this high density zone deep into this lower, much less dense zone area.
Okay. And so what is the regulatory structure for this zone?
Sorry, I cut you off.
Sorry, the zone and the district.
Mm-hmm. So the Kitsap County comprehensive plan establishes goals and priorities for this entire area. Within that comprehensive plan, there's a subplan area for Silverdale specifically. And then there are also design standards for Silverdale. And then within those design standards, there are district design standards for different portions of Silverdale. And then, of course, there is the county code as well, which is the zoning code that will cover issues such as the regional center aspect of this site, the the density, the dimensions, and other design aspects, how projects are reviewed for land use review, and various other design criteria for different types of structures, in this case, multifamily structures. And there's, of course, landscaping and other site design aspects as well. There's language in all of these aspects of the code that point to how a designer and developer should approach the design of their proposal. If I were to highlight some from the land use code 17420.010, there is a subparagraph B. It says, ensure new family development is sensitive to the character of surrounding neighborhoods, for example. Subparagraph E, that is readily accessible open space. Paragraph F ensures compatibility of dissimilar adjoining land uses. Paragraph G, maintain and improve the character, appearance, and livability of established neighborhoods by protecting them from incompatible uses, excessive noise, illumination, loss of privacy, and similar significant impacts. And H encourages creativity and flexibility in the design of multifamily developments that allows the developer and the designer to maximize unique site attributes and is compatible with the character and identity of adjoining land use. So that is some of the highlights, I would say, from the land use code. I also point out that the land use code is structured to make the design guidelines, which is a separate document, enforceable. So 17.470.020, subparagraph B, that the requirement section of the following design criteria apply to each multifamily project requiring conditional use review or administrative conditional use. And subparagraph B, the requirement sections of the design criteria state the design criteria that each project shall meet. These design criteria are intended to supplement the design standards of UCR, UM, UH zones.
So in this case,
trying to read through, sorry, how, yes.
So how you've gone through some of, you know, these design criteria for multifamily development, purpose, intent to be sensitive of the character, how has the applicant addressed the design standards that you've and the design criteria and the Silverdale design standards that you've discussed so far?
Yeah, so may I bring up the perspective of the project the site plan?
For the record, that would be DCD 33, I believe.
Thank you.
You want the site plan or the elevation, the outer design?
I'll start with the site plan again that we've already been looking at.
Okay.
There, hopefully that's coming up on your screen at this point. Is it there on your screen?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Great. The same exhibit I was illustrating on earlier. Again, it shows the four larger structures and the smaller clubhouse structure. What I didn't point to earlier is that between all of these structures, what you basically see is fundamentally large areas of driveways and parking lots There's very little green space left. So the overall effect is of these large bars, if you will, these long, narrow buildings floating in a sea of parking and driveways. I'm going to switch over to the three-dimensional view that was provided by the applicant here. These are elevation views, which are side views, if you will, of the structures.
Just for the record, we're moving to the elevation. So it looks like this might be, I don't know, DCD 24.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And then there also in the same set of documents was perspectives provided by the applicant. Is that the same exhibit number?
Yes.
So what we see in these two drawings are the again the elevational views, which are the side views of the structure. The four drawings that are on this sheet represent a somewhat typical condition of all four buildings that are proposed. So this is only showing the elevational views of one typical building. The response by the applicant, design response to the applicant was to design these four-story buildings with these large parapets only on one side, strangely enough. So I will point to these parapets in my illustrations. So the parapets are colored in this blue color at the top, and they are on the sides of the structures on the two short sides of the building. But you can see that from the quote unquote backside, the parapets, and I am pointing to the backside of the parapet on the northeast elevation of this drawing set are just blank. There's no detail to them there at all. So presumably it's just would be some sort of roofing or waterproofing material that would be visible. So you have these already fairly tall buildings with then this false parapet wall on top. And you also have a series of basically flat roofs. I'm circling a flat roof on a tower element. And of course, the majority of the roof of the entire structure is flat as well. There are these small shed roofs here. I am circling some shed roofs on the northeast elevation that provide shelter to an exterior stair structure. The colors of the buildings are these tans and grays. It's unclear exactly other than these renderings what the actual colors would be, but it's implying that there's this dark blue color on top on a parapet wall, and then the bulk of the building are these tans and grays. There white vinyl windows are being called out, and then some sort of a small amount of stone veneer on one side of the structure. In the illustration that I'm circling, it's this southwest elevation. There is a clubhouse structure that's incidental. I can show the drawing of that as well at some point, but it's a one-story structure and it doesn't have the impact. Actually, I don't have an elevation of that in front of me, so I won't show it. But there is a one-story clubhouse structure as well that will be in the south west corner of the lot.
Okay. Now, before we kind of dive into more of the details, can you just provide, you know, what are your main conclusions about this design?
Sure. So obviously this building is seeking to create the most number of units possible on this site. It's four stories and four buildings, incredible amount of density, incredible amount of parking associated with that density packed onto the site. It does not satisfy several requirements of the Silverdale design standards, such as, you know, addressing view impacts, aesthetic, addressing the surrounding properties and the residential context that exists from a design perspective. The parking design itself has some shortcomings, significant shortcomings, as well as requirements for landscaping open space.
Okay, so let's get into the first one that you mentioned regarding the view preservation. Do the design standards provide for preservation of marine and mountain views?
Yeah, that's correct. The Silverdale Design Standards 1.1.1 urban form states that to encourage a compact growth pattern that makes wise use of available land, promotes sound investment throughout the community by encouraging infill, redevelopment, and building that goes up rather than out, while at the same time preserving marine and mountain vistas. And then in particular, the waterfront district in the Silverdale Design Center is 1.6.5, that the Guy's Inlet is a visual connector as well as a partial physical connector for the Old Town and waterfront districts. And then the access to view is a physical identity element for properties in the waterfront district. And the Silverdale Design Standards point out the properties adjacent to Buckland Hill Road and near Dyes Inlet enjoy partial views of Dyes Inlet and the Clear Creek Corridor, which is the Design Standards 9.1. And as I described before, the topography of this waterfront district is uphill from the north and east and slopes down across the site to the south and west. And it turns out that the views are from a majority portion of the site also are from that uphill side, which is to the north and east again, and looking down towards the south and west towards Dyes Inlet. So since this lot covers such a large percentage of the southern border of the waterfront district, and the bulk and height of these buildings will therefore obstruct such a huge portion of that boundary, it stands to reason that the many views from the waterfront district to the water will be disrupted or outright blocked because of this project.
Now, you mentioned the height and number of, you know, the height and bulk, but what about the orientation of the buildings as well? Will those impact views?
Right, so going back to the site plan, and hopefully it's come back up on your screen. We will see that the buildings are oriented at roughly a 45 degree angle relative to east-west and also relative to the general orientation of the site. which is an odd design choice because, as described before, and I've just highlighted the buildings again on the site plan to show their fortified degree orientation relative to the orientation of the site. It's an odd choice because that means that the bulk of the buildings, the long facades, are blocking the primary views across the site. And as I described, the slope and the views really come from the northeast corner and move and go across the site in a southwesterly direction. And so these buildings seem to be oriented in such a way that maximizes the view blockage across the site, especially from those perspectives. So as I showed at the beginning of the presentation, and I'll show again later, for example, the view from the adjoining restaurant to the north of the site is blocked very effectively, if you will, by the orientation of the buildings on this site. We can show that image again.
Can you show the kind of two images?
Yeah, and I'm gonna flip to that. Sorry, it's slow to do this, but for some reason I can't seem to share multiple things at the same time. So, or at least I don't have that skill set in my head. And there we go. So, share there. Okay. So, this is a view standing on the patio of the restaurant to the north of the subject parcel. And you can see that and this is looking towards the southwest, towards the water. You can barely make out a little peekaboo view of water between the buildings, but largely the view has been blocked. And if you see the view before, and this is this photograph taken from the same location. Maybe we'll share that. There we go. That is the view taken from the same location. You see the fire feature in the front there. You can see that this property enjoys a spectacular view of the water currently that would almost be totally blocked by the proposal, and the orientation of the buildings certainly makes that even worse because of their basically turning their long side right across perpendicular to the view corridor across this parcel.
And I'd like to admit this is from exhibit 13, an image from that folder.
Okay.
So I'd point out that the Kitsap County Code 17.540.040 points out that obstruction of view is materially detrimental to existing uses or property in the immediate vicinity. And that would absolutely be the case here.
And
Mr. Adams, and that was, I'm sorry, 17.54.540. Did I hear you correctly?
17.540.040. Yes.
Point 40. Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. CUP criteria. So, all right. And then, so would you say that this development impacts the identity of other buildings within the waterfront district? By depriving them of the views, do you have an opinion about that?
Yes, I absolutely. I mean, these properties enjoy those views. And it's called out as a feature of this district. And stands to reason that any impact on the southern border of this district would potentially block views. So that should be something that should have been considered and prioritized by any reviewing authority.
All right. Now, could you discuss, so the Silverdale waterfront design standards require that new designs be respectful of existing single family development. Can you go through and discuss, do you believe that this development is respectful of the single family residential development?
I do not think it's respectful. I'd like to show some views from Exhibit 13, if that's all right, which we've collected. This is a view of the general area. This is actually close to one's back being to the subject parcel. Looking towards the water. The existing structures on the site are these pitched roof. These aren't very clear, are they? Are they coming through clearly for you guys or not?
I can see the photos. There's one main photo of a home.
Yep. So this home is actually on the subject parcel, so it's not been maintained, but it's very characteristic of the vernacular of buildings that you see, which is Pacific Northwestern craftsman or even agrarian style home with pitched roofs, gable fronts, nice columns. You see the density of the housing. It's basically one story plus maybe a dormer for the most part in the area. These are more homes in the immediate vicinity of the structure, the subject parcel. Again, just to give everyone a feeling of the site. This photograph that's on the screen, you should see behind the hedge, you should see the white house and then and to the right, a red barn. The white house was the house I showed earlier. These two structures are actually on the site. Again, very typical of a Northwestern agrarian vernacular. This home is also within a few hundred yards of the subject parcel, as are these homes as well, which are a little bit more recently built. This structure is immediately adjacent to the subject lot, so it is the subject lot is to the left. There's a low concrete wall at the very edge of the photograph. That's basically the southern boundary of the subject parcel. But you see, this is more recently built home, again, gable roof, fairly simple Northwestern vernacular, perhaps craftsman architecture. Also note the beautiful barn structure behind it, which is just a gorgeous little building. The property that is directly to the east of the subject parcel. Again, one story, steeply sloped, gable roof, nice dormers. So that gives you a flavor of the structures that dominate the surrounding zone that surrounds the subject parcel on the south, east, and west side. So the the code requests and it requires that new design be respectful of existing single family residential developments. And I think it's important to emphasize that it's calling out existing single family residential development. It's not requiring that the design be respectful of, you know, the Krista Shores project that is in the area of this project, which is a few lots over, that maybe an applicant might point to and say, that's what we're following. Or other larger scaled structures in the Silverdale waterfront district, it has to be respectful of existing single family residential developments. And you just don't see in those photographs that I showed any sort of relationship to the project that is being proposed. So if I return back to the imagery I showed earlier. Hopefully you are seeing again the applicant's building elevations, and in particular the three-dimensional views of the perspectives. I just don't see any relationship whatsoever or any sort of nod or any kind of architectural treatment that I would interpret as responding to, respecting, tipping your hat, if you will, architecturally and design-wise to the existing fabric that surrounds the site. Instead, I see these large blue cornices with a somewhat bizarre overscaled cornice elements that are, and these strange flat roofs that are kind of glued on top of it, which have no architectural precedent in the area whatsoever that I can tell. Don't see any notion of gable roof or dormers or scaling things, you know, mitigating the scale to try to make these buildings feel less tall. In fact, the parapet structure on top, which is the blue structure with the cornices, actually really make the building feel even taller and in fact add height to the building that wouldn't be strictly necessary. And the somewhat techy arrangement of the stairs that are shown on the north perspective of this view, with the steel columns holding up these sloped roof elements that are shed roofs, or they're not even shed roofs, they're sort of free floating of flying roof elements. Don't relate at all to anything we see in the surrounding area. This is a very kind of techie, kind of structurally expressive type of architecture that you would see in a much more urban context, especially with all of these little diagonal struts that are holding up these various roof elements. And so I frankly just, you know, do not see any kind of acknowledgement or attempt to create an architecture that has any sort of relationship to the existing fabric that we see in the existing architectural design that we see in the single family homes in the area.
And which sections of the Silverdale design standards speak to this, the context, the residential context, and being respectful of the single family development?
So right off the bat, we have Silverdale design standards 9.3B. which is the new design will be the language there. So the new design will be respectful of existing single family residential development. And then we also have Silverdale Design Standards 9.4.1A. Building orientation for new housing will reflect the existing residential building context as well. Within the comprehensive plan, we have land use goal 1 and land use policy number 1 that reads, establish specific development standards for medium and high density developments to ensure compatibility adjacent to existing low density neighborhoods. And the comprehensive plan on page 1.11, it's 1-11, excuse me. The comprehensive plan says ensure compatibility between adjacent zones. I should also point out that obviously this is a much, much larger scaled structure than any of the adjacent single family structures in the area. When we look at these kinds of large scaled structures, it's often good design practice to figure out ways to mitigate the height, bulk, and scale of the structure through treatments of facade modulation and other architectural features. And there's you have to acknowledge there's some of that here with the balconies and the change in the facades bumping in and out. But there's a lot of features that really make these buildings much more tall and massive feeling than all the adjacent structures. And in some ways, the balconies hurt as much as they help because they create a great deal of opportunities for the neighboring parcels to feel spied upon by people that are standing on these balconies. So there's a loss of privacy that these balconies imply. As well. And you also just see that these buildings really are the same repeating three bays of gray shingles over one bay of stone below over and over and over again. So there's a certain kind of relentlessness to the design of these buildings that just make them feel long and tall and big. And then I'll just harp on that parapet wall again. We have this just bright blue parapet up there that just seems to be sort of decorative. I can't imagine what it's really there for since it only exists on three sides of the building. And it just makes the building feel even taller and really draws your eye up to the corners of the building, which your eye is inclined to do anyway, but it doesn't. It accentuates the height and bulk of this building. So there's a lot of design choices here that really make the problem of height, bulk, and scale worse in this proposal.
Okay, so moving on from the incompatibility issue, can you discuss how the project addresses yards and open space and parking? Let's start with open space and yards.
Okay, so yards are an interesting question. There's a requirement in the I'm trying to find the code reference here. And I just lost my place, I apologize. There's requirement that there's a relationship of front yards and an urban pattern that relate to the old town neighborhood. So that is Silverdale Design Standards 2.5.2, which state landscape front yard pattern of old town West Hill neighborhood and waterfront districts based on the historic old town typology. So what that is suggesting is that you create buildings that have a discernible front yard to them, usually related to the front door of the building, that present a street presence to the pedestrian walking by or entering the building. And that typology is really is a common approach, especially in planning movements such as new urbanism that have been being used across the country for decades now, where you try to get back to that finer scaled, finer grained urban quality of smaller buildings with front doors facing the street, with front yards, no parking, parking's around the back, if it does exist. And this project doesn't have any of that. I mean, it just reminds me of the type of modernism that we would see in the 50s and 60s of mass housing projects, you know, or low-income housing projects, like Cabrini Green in Chicago was a notorious one, but they're all over the country, where you have these large bar buildings, repetitive units stacked on top of each other, floating in a sea of parking, and this kind of strange, you know, concrete, wasteland of space, and this, that is the urban pattern that this project is somehow replicating, whether they know it or not. It has nothing to do with that kind of old town character and design of smaller buildings, or at least buildings that appear to have smaller facade pieces fronting the street and providing these front yards. And on a site that's this large, I'm not suggesting that all of these buildings have to front Mickleberry, which is the road that is that fronts this lot, which is actually very narrow there on the west side. But there is necessarily an interior street requirement of a lot that this is large to get cars to move around the site and for people to access parking near their building. So within the site, you would expect to see, if the old town typology was picked up, you'd expect to see kind of a reflection within the site of these buildings having this front yard kind of quality, parking being somehow moved behind the structure in terms of how people would approach the building, and you would create these front yards within the site. You would create a breakdown in the buildings that allow for the parking to be better addressed, and for you these clear kind of front yards, which then translate to open space and pedestrian environments to give each building or each entry point to the building a notion that they are they have their own pedestrian front yard, and the parking is moved elsewhere. So, this can be done. You do see projects with high intensity parking requirements. For instance, the University Village Mall in Seattle is a really outstanding example, if any of it has been there, of how you have an incredible amount of parking that is woven into the the structure of the fabric of the University Village to provide a true pedestrian space with connected open spaces, and you don't feel like you're dancing through the parking stalls in your whole time there. There's a park lane in Kirkland where they were able to you know, still provide parking on the street to serve that street, but yet they create all kinds of treatments to the landscape and the paving and slowing down cars and providing
features. Subject, real quick, just we're kind of getting really off base. We were talking about the waterfront district, now we're into Old Town and now we're into University Village. Mr. Brickland said he was going to conclude his presentation of evidence by 11. This was an hour witness, and it doesn't seem like we're wrapping up, and there's still people to go, and now we're pretty far afield. So I just have concerns because, you know, the applicant and the county want to have time for our witnesses as well, and we only have two days set for this hearing. And I don't really see how the Old Town is relevant. I don't see how University District in Seattle is relevant. And I just want us to get more focused on the issues that are before the hearing examiner and kind of stay on topic so that we can get through this.
The Old Town discussion is in the Silverdale design standards. And I think we're on the last few points. So I don't think we have a whole lot more to go after this. I can't hear you. Sorry.
There, I've unmuted myself. Yeah, so I'll thank you for that clarification, Ms. Clungeon. And yes, I'll allow the testimony. I think the examples of projects that are elsewhere, I think it's kind of to illustrate alternative designs in terms of how these the identified concerns can be addressed. So, though I do understand the concern on timing. Please proceed.
So again, the Old Town typology is a requirement for the Silverdale Design Standards 2.52. I'll also point out that in Silverdale Design Standards 9.4.3.A, states parking will be limited to rear or side yards, which feeds into the same argument I was just making about providing front yards, if you will. And it also suggests that parking should be under the building where feasible for multi-unit buildings. That's Silverdale Design Standards 9.4.3.3. As an architect, I read all of those things collectively as meaning that parking needs to be dealt with in a sensitive and appropriate way to create these better open space and pedestrian conditions, which is what I was trying to get to with my examples. And this project doesn't do that. It does not create any of this front yard experiences, does not create really any usable open space except at extreme corners of the lot. Fundamentally, if you are gonna circulate as a pedestrian, you are constantly crossing parking lots and driveways from one building to the next. There is a narrow 5-foot wide sidewalk at the northern edge of the property, but that is it's a pretty bleak experience to walk down that long, several hundred foot, walkway, trapped on the far side of the lot, separated from everything else by the driveways and the parking lots. So that's what I would like to say about parking. There are several site design guidelines that also relate to parking from the land use code 17.470.90 is the overall section, and then subparagraph B1 requires locate surface parking at rear or side of lot, so that supports the same argument I was trying to make about front yards. Locate parking areas are less visible from the street, which is subparagraph B5. Locate a driveway so they're visually less dominant, paragraphs B6 and B9. says limit parking lots and street frontage is 30% of the street frontage. So all of those, again, I would say all of those features are support that I was discussing earlier, also supported by the zoning code. I'm just going to go on to open space, if that's all right with everybody. I've hinted at several of those requirements already in talking about parking and pedestrian access, looking at the land use code, zoning code 17.470.070. And it says requirement open space shall be provided in adjacent to multifamily developments for all residents of the development. And the guidelines in that requirement are give several strategies for the applicant. Combine open space and contiguous properties to provide larger viable open space areas. Site permanent outdoor recreation equipment away from storm drain facilities. Use walkways to connect open space, multifamily buildings, parking areas, adjacent neighborhoods. I'll emphasize that. Incorporate a variety of activities, consider drainage retention areas and enhance the environment and open space usage. The open space areas that are provided here are largely cut off from the units by the large parking lot. Again, you have to do the dance across parking lots and driveways to get to the open space areas that are provided. I should show the site plan.
Mr. Adams, can you repeat the code citation that you just provided, 17.470? I missed the rest of it.
17.470.070. It's another one with it. It's two numbers that are the same, almost the same.
Thank you.
So we see that we have a portion of open space here-ish by the community center, which is I'm pointing to the far western end of the lot. And then there is some open space provided here, and I am pointing to the southeastern corner of the lot. The southeastern corner of the lot, however, is a dog park. So to the degree that would be considered open space, it's really obviously for dog owners or dogs. The rest of the site does have some landscaping, if you will, but it's dwarfed compared to all of the parking lots. So if I use a different color to highlight the parking lot areas, see that all of this area is parking and driveways. And there's very little left. And I am circling all of the parking lots for the transcript here. There's very little left that isn't building and is not parking. So we have, we don't really have contiguous open space. We don't really have people in individual buildings to have direct access to open space. They have to cross a series of parking lots and potentially walk along a very narrow walkway in the northern edge of the site to get to the open space. And in fact, the walkway that is provided doesn't even connect the walkway at the northern edge of the parking lot, which I will highlight for everybody. It is here at the northern edge of the lot, doesn't even connect directly to the clubhouse and the open space. You have to cross this parking lot at some point to get there. There's also guidelines for recreation centers. This should be adequate parking. They do meet that requirement, it seems, but It should be directly connected by a series of walkways to the multifamily building. So we don't have a series of walkways. We have a walkway, and it is not connected to that open space. It does not appear there are bike parking facilities, although that might just be the scale of the plan that I'm reviewing, and it's in there somewhere. And then I would like to move on to some landscape, unless you have other questions regarding parking and open space.
See here. So in your opinion, this project does not satisfy the open space and parking requirements?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. And see, one of the requirements is that they incorporate a variety of activities for all age groups in the active recreational open space. Do you see that anywhere in the design?
I don't see that. I see a dog park, and I see the clubhouse structure, but there's no indication of what activities are other than the dog, walking your dog at the dog park. There's unclear what activities are provided.
Okay. So now you can proceed with landscaping. Thank you.
So I will just touch on some landscape design guidelines. These are design aspects. I'm not going to try to argue that I understand what trees are being planted, whatnot, but I am capable and very often do review site plans and need to understand what we see on site plans. And what they have suggested in their design is that they cannot, cannot plant the required trees that are required in the parking lots. Trying to get to that section of the code.
I think this, for the landscaping, that's the 17470.080.
Yes, thank you. And sorry, I got lost here. I was looking at 17.490.40B. One street tree shall be provided at the ends of each row of parking spaces, and a minimum of one street tree shall be provided for each 15 spaces. The application specifically says that they cannot provide that. That they will not meet that requirement because they have to install lighting. And it's just it's a ridiculous claim, because all parking lots have lighting and most parking lots have trees, and there's no way that the trees have to conflict with light poles. First of all, light poles can be scaled to be much taller than trees if the landscape architect would pick appropriately sized trees with appropriate canopies. There's no reason why lighting cannot be also provided. You can also provide additional light layouts. You can provide lighting that is at the bollard height, so that's basically waist height lighting that would illuminate the parking lot underneath the trees. You can provide wall-mounted lighting on the structures. There are tons of strategies to provide lighting and trees. So they've immediately eliminated trees right off the top of the bat from as required in the parking lots. Then we also see back to the 17.470.080 that you just referenced, which are the landscape design guidelines. Minimize tree removal. They are clear cutting the entire site. Provide frameworks for plants to grow on. I do not see any frameworks. So trellises, arbors, incorporate planter guards or low planter walls as part of the architecture. I don't see planter guards, which would be instead of using guardrails, you'd have planting boxes that prevent people from falling off of raised areas. There are two planters as over by the clubhouse, but otherwise there are no planters on this very large site. Landscape open areas created by building modulation. They're doing some of that, but really they're just kind of shrink wrapping the building in on a line of landscaping. There isn't really any kind of discernible landscape treatment that I can see on the site plan that emphasizes or de-emphasizes the building modulation. It's just a simple line of planting that goes around the buildings in the jogs of the building. Incorporate upper story planter boxes or roof plants, that has just simply not been done. Yet retain natural green belt vegetation. This site has an incredible amount of relationship to the existing area, and I just don't see how they're relating to the existing fields and the forest that is to the east of the site. So I don't feel they've respected that. In fact, they've kind of cut off the forested area to the east with a large storage, a one-story storage facility. And there's a suggestion of incorporating vegetation-based LIDs and BMPs. That is not my area of expertise. However, I do not see those notated on the site plan, and I would be happy if they would incorporate that as well. That's if they're going to claim that this building has some sustainable aspects, that would be a good one to achieve. But I do not see it at all on the on this proposal.
Okay. Great. So can you just, in your opinion, you know, does the project does not satisfy the ACUP criteria? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there are a number of things that I say that do not provide the criteria. With in terms of meeting the requirements of the land use code, excuse me, the zoning code, the comprehensive plan, the Silverdale design standards, it doesn't relate to any of the single family structures in the area. It blocks very significant views. From the entire sub-district, the waterfront district, and will absolutely impact the views that the district enjoys to the waterfront. It is contextually completely out of scale with the structure and doesn't show any of the kind of transitional aspects of the design that would really be required for a project that is at the very edge of the zone boundary, the very edge of this district boundary, and in fact protrudes into the adjacent zones in a very unusual way that should have been highlighted by the reviewing body as, you know, an unusual and frankly undesirable condition of the zoning and the district. And so therefore there should be a large burden put on this project to provide some sort of transition beyond just what's already in the code. And clearly the code says you have to relate to these single family homes. You have to provide this sort of transitional aspects, and this project does none of those things. And those transitional design features should be paramount in this design, in this location. And it simply does not meet any of those sorts of requirements.
Other questions? Thank you.
So I think we're going to need to take a short 15-minute break. It's 10:40. I'm wondering if we can break until 10:55. Okay, and then I don't know how much cross there is, but so far there hasn't been a lot, so that probably should wrap up this witness fairly quickly. So we'll break briefly until 10:55.
All right,
thank you all.
Thank you.